Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
A leaked transcript from the New York Times reveals the Gray Ladies' next step in their Trump resistance plan, pivoting from the failed Russian hoax to reframing America's founding as racist. Meanwhile, real freedom fighters in Hong Kong capture the true spirit of 1776, waving the American flag and singing our national anthem in protest to mainland China's political regime. Right now, please, before we get started, press subscribe. Get one other friend to do so. Give it those 5-star ratings. Leave a review. That helps us surge in the charts so much. Please give us those 5-star ratings and leave a review. This is Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show, your home of rational, conservative, libertarian thinking. Here we go. A recent Gallup survey shows Americans worry more about burglary than any other crime. More than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft, and even murder. According to studies, just 10%. Just over 10% of break-ins are planned beforehand. So what does that really mean? That means the rest are spur of the moment. They're crimes of opportunity. In other words, totally and completely random. Did you know most break-ins happen between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m.? Right in the middle of the day when you're at work, you're taking the kids to soccer, right in the middle of the day. So I'm going to ask you a question. What's protecting your house? What's protecting your house? According to the FBI, the average loss in a burglar is over $2,000. This can be so hard to recover from. There are over 2 million burglaries reported every single year. That's one every 13 seconds. So by the time I get done with this live read, there will already be 5 burglaries in this country. I hope it wasn't your house or your apartment. But if you had Simply Safe, that could make sure that does not happen. This prevents bad things from happening, reports it quickly. How does it do it? Well, Simply Safe is the top choice. Every piece of property I care about has Simply Safe. Their police dispatched up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. They make it easy on you. There's no contract, no hidden fees or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. It's easy to order and easy setup, usually under an hour. It's won a ton of awards from CNET to the New York Times Wirecutter. Prices are always fair and honest. Around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. Visit simplysafe.com/Charlie. You get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/Charlie so they know our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/Charlie. All right, everybody. Welcome to the Charlie Kirk Show. We're going to dive right into it. Russia, racism, recession. The three R's. And so I was on my good friend Steve Hilton's show recently. And so my friend Katrina Pearson made this point of Russia, racism, and recession, kind of the three R's of how the left continues to go to attack Donald Trump. And in a way that you couldn't have asked for better evidence to actually prove that this is exactly what the media is doing and changes their narrative when one of these does not work. There was a leaked transcript from the New York Times. I'm going to read it word for word, and bear with me. So the New York Times, the alleged paper of record, the New York Times that is delivered to millions of homes every single day and gets tens of millions of page views a month, that many people cite as the best paper in America, which I think is laughable at best. They are determined to create a narrative to destabilize and to destroy Donald Trump. And don't take my words for it. This is a leaked transcript. Mr. Producer, who said this?
This is the editor of the New York Times.
This is a leaked transcript. Now, quote, it's quite a paragraph, so bear with me. The day Bob Mueller walked off that witness stand, two things happened. Our readers, who want Donald Trump to go away, suddenly thought, quote, holy bleep, Bob Mueller is not going to do it, end quote. And Donald Trump got a little emboldened politically, I think, because, you know, for obvious reasons. And I think that the story changed. A lot of the stuff we're talking about started to emerge like 6 or 7 weeks ago. We're a little tiny bit flat-footed. I mean, that's what happens when a story looks a certain way for 2 years, right? I think we've got to change. I mean, the vision for coverage for the next 2 years is what I talked about earlier. How do we cover a guy who makes these kind of remarks? How do we cover the world's reaction to him? How do we do that while continuing to cover his policies? How do we cover America that's become so divided by Donald Trump? How do we grapple with all the stuff you all are talking about? How do we write about race in a thoughtful way, something we haven't done in a large way in a long time? That, to me, is the vision for coverage. You are all going to have to help us shape that vision, but I think that's what we're going to have to do for the rest of the next 2 years. End quote. This is extraordinary. This is the editor of not the Democrat Party. This is not the editor of a political action committee. This is not the chairman of the House Democrat Committee. This is an editor of a supposed journalistic institution that is acting as a proxy of the Democrat Party. I mean, this is an extraordinary statement where he admits that the narrative of Russia is totally done. Not only that, he says, quote, we're a tiny bit flat-footed. You mean that all the lies that you've been pushing at the American people have proven to actually be that, lies? And he says, I mean, that's what happens when a story looks a certain way for a certain 2 years, right? Yeah, no kidding. When there's no evidence of collusion, when the only collusion is actually done by the Democrat Party, when there's a FISA investigation that goes to show the Democrats are actually the ones that illegally spied and colluded against Donald Trump, all of a sudden, the big shift has to happen, right, Mr. Producer? The big shift. And so what is articulated in this memo, and I believe the editor was talking to some of his direct reports, because it kind of sounded like a locker room pep talk, doesn't it? This is him trying to fire up the troops. Well, folks, we really screwed up this Russia thing. We did get the House, the Democrats, the House back, but now we have to recalibrate. And I want all of you with me in our mission to destroy Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like to me. It sounded like this is the resistance, and this is how we are going to
this
resist.
This sounded like a battle plan in some form of a bunker.
Yep.
That was just kind of an honest autopsy of, well, we've been screwing up this Russia thing. Let's go to the next thing.
Yeah, let's translate what he actually said. We got Russia completely wrong.
Totally
wrong.
So how
are we going to beat Trump? Well, we're going to call him a racist.
So let me get this straight. I have to just pick apart his entire statement. He's kind of meandering with his – it's like a flow of consciousness here, and I sort of get that. I understand how these meetings work. So this is what I laugh at. First of all, he says, how do we cover America that's become so divided by Donald Trump? Can we just debunk this myth once and for all that Donald Trump is the person that bitterly divided our country? I mean, America has been growing more and more divided. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. That's the law of physics. And the same can be said for politics. I mean, America has been growing more. First of all, we've been growing more and more divided over the last 30, 40 years for a variety of different reasons. The extrapolation of the power in Washington, D.C., the power concentrated in the cities, rural America being disenfranchised for a variety of different reasons. And secondly, and I don't actually think we're as divided. I think that the division actually comes from the people like the New York Times. It's the New York Times that is dividing us. It's the New York Times that is intentionally misrepresenting. I mean, here's a good question to the editor of the New York Times. What role do you think you're playing in the division of America when you're talking like this? When you think that your paper should be nothing more than a political weapon to go after those that you disagree with? And here's the other thing, Mr. Producer, that I got such a kick out of. He says, how do we write about race in a thoughtful way, something we haven't done in a large way in a long time? All they write about is race. I mean, you can't pick up the New York Times without some sort of article about the racial divide in our country and white privilege. And
there was actually an independent reporter that did a LexisNexis search on keywords that the New York Times used regarding race relations, like, you know, prejudice, oppression, white patriarchy, these types of things. And it was a really, really fascinating find because he saw that there was an inflection point around 2009, 2010, where these words were seldom used within the pages of the New York Times. And then all of a sudden, like a rocket ship, they inflected way up. So that's 2009. And, you know, the correlation is not lost on, I think, a lot of us on the right. What happened in 2008, 2009 that changed the American political landscape?
Barack Obama got elected president of the United States. So there's so much nonsense in this transcript. But this should be a fire alarm for all of you that are listening, that if you think we have a fair, open, and honest press, this is the editor of the biggest paper in the country openly directing his staff to now shift their attack on the president away from Russia on to racism. Now that's the new attack. And so you see this to their new big project. So what's the left trying? What's the New York Times going to do? Are they going to investigate, I don't know, how Donald Trump got spied on by the Democrats? Are they going to investigate maybe the failure of our urban cities? Are they going to investigate, I don't know, the best economy in American history? No, they're not going to do any of that. Instead, you know what their big, bold plan is? Four numbers, 1619. What is that? What is 1619? What's 1619? It's called Project 1619. So how do they create that narrative of racism in America? Well, answer, with the 1619 Project, which essentially says the history of America did not begin in 1776, but instead in 1619, when slaves were first brought to the North American continent. So, Mr. Producer, what else does it say?
The brazenness of the New York Times in this regard is something to behold. I mean, they're not hiding what they're trying to do here. They say about the 1619 Project, quote, it aims to reframe the country's history. I mean, can we stop right there? I mean, that's a profound thing to say.
But this is so important because the left leads us to believe that history in America has been written incorrectly. We're going to spend a fair amount of time on this entire topic because I think it's so fundamentally important. And this is a precursor and a harbinger of some of the talking points of the left that is going to come in the 2016 election. And so the 1619 narrative is trying to make us look retrospectively, which I'm not against whatsoever, back 400 years to when slavery began in Jamestown, Virginia. But the core of the argument in the whole 1619 Project, and that what the left is trying to say, is that there were huge benefits that happened because of slavery, and that slaves built this country, and that because of slavery, there was a tremendous amount of inequality that was built because of it. And there is some truth to the sense that the people who were slaves were obviously, you know, disenfranchised for quite some time. But at the basis of the argument is that somehow America benefited from slavery.
Well, and not only that they call 1619, the New York Times, again, this is the New York Times saying it themselves, understanding 1619 as our true founding and placing the consequences of slavery and the contributions of black Americans at the very center of the story we tell ourselves about who we are.
So let's start with this first question. Is slavery and the countries and the civilizations that engage in slavery, is it really beneficial for those countries? And believe it, I mean, no. The answer is no. Actually, slavery is horrible economics. Not only is it a horrible sin, is it completely and totally unacceptable. It should be repudiated at every turn. But from 1619 to 1776, America experienced very little to no economic growth. Because when you have... First of all, here's what happens when you have slavery. There's very little incentive, if any, for the slave owners, if you will, to continue on entrepreneurial activity because there's very little competition. I mean, your idea of growing your business is to have more people subservient to you, and that doesn't make a lot of sense. But also, the people that are doing the work or doing the actual slave labor, there's little to no middle-class purchasing power. So there's very little market for goods. And this is really an important point. So embedded in the leftist argument is somehow saying that slavery, our country somehow benefited from slavery. And that this is incorrect. This is not true whatsoever. So let's just go through some facts. Slavery has been illegal in the United States for 154 years. It has been illegal since the founding of our country for some northern states. It was abolished by Republicans with the passage of the 13th Amendment. That's right, Republicans. It was Republicans that abolished slavery, and it was Republicans that abolished slavery as an anti-slavery party in 1860. And you kind of look at the economies of North and the South. So slavery in the North began being outlawed state by state, starting with Vermont in 1777. By 1804, slavery was officially outlawed in northern states. Many states adopted gradual emancipation measures. By 1840, slavery has basically disappeared in the North. While factories were built all over the North and the South, the vast majority of industrial manufacturing was taking place in the North. So if slavery was really so great, if slavery was this thing that actually was an economic benefit for the country, why is that the North did so much better economically than the South? Slavery is really bad economics. Slavery has existed for 5,000 years, well before the founding of America. And guess what? It kept people permanently poor and kept those civilizations and those countries and those cultures poor. Not only is slavery evil, but it's really, really bad economics. Because you don't have entrepreneurship, you don't have individual freedom, and it keeps a majority of your population permanently as an underclass.
Well, and what it did, I think, especially in the southern economies, is it kept them stuck to an agrarian economic model.
That's
that
right.
As the world started passing them by, they were too stuck and too fixed to a model that depended upon slave labor. And so they missed the proverbial boat when it came to the economy growing rapidly in the North. And the North, because it wasn't married to this terrible, terrible system, was able to change with the times much, much more.
That's right.
Adeptly.
And so the North was able to have far more economic activity and success than the South because of its resistance and because of its rejection of the evil of slavery. So, for example, the North had 5 times the number of factories as the South and over 10 times the number of factory workers. In addition, 90% of the nation's skilled workers were in the North. And so as the South tried to hang on to the evil of slavery, they fell behind economically. And so the success of our country, if you're actually trying to accurately tell the story of America, the New York Times, if you're trying to tell the actual why our country became great and progressed away from it, it's because we had rejection of slavery. And so the true founding was not 1619. Are you kidding me? I mean, the true founding was 1776, but we started to abolish slavery in 1777. I mean, the founding of our country really started with the Declaration of Independence, followed by the emancipation of the Constitution. But we started to have the rejection and the repudiation of the evil of slavery as early in Vermont in 1777. I disagree with Vermont on a lot of things, but these are one of the things that I will say they did a great job with. But embedded in this argument, and I find this all the time on campus leftists, is some of the work that we do at Turning Point USA, tpusa.com, they say, well, Charlie, slavery, so many people benefited because of slavery. And I make the argument, the Southern states barely benefited from it. You had a couple slave owners in particular that benefited. But by the way, a lot of those slave owners had their land taken away from them, had their plantations burned, and they were held accountable for what they did. Not all of them, but a good amount of them. And so America was negatively actually impacted by the economics of slavery. And that's the argument we have to make.
What the New York Times would have you believe is that all of the wealth of this great nation, I mean, $23 trillion GDP, that somehow it's all connected to the backs of slaves. And what I think the bigger point here is that actually where slavery was allowed to exist as long as it did into the 1860s and the Civil War in the South, it hurt them. It hurt those economies. The wealth was not built by them. Wealth was sapped by that decision to stay married to slavery. Wealth was not grown. It was a massive opportunity cost that the South experienced, and that's a story that you're not going to hear in the New York Times.
So right, and so the second question we have to ask is, did slavery make the United States richer?
Exactly right. Yeah.
And the answer to that question is no. It didn't, because your country is not getting richer when people are living in servitude. So what makes the free market so beautiful is entrepreneurial activity and personal freedom. And so when you have people that aren't allowed to own property, that aren't citizens, the country is negatively harmed by those things. And these should be obvious arguments. I mean, I don't think anyone's making a pro-slavery argument, but the argument the left is making is that America was somehow benefited from slavery. And that is incorrect. And I'm not trying to dull the contributions at all of people that were in fact slaves. I'm not trying to say that there's some, I think it's horrendous what our country did. But understand, this is really, really important. Argument that is not made enough. The South is still reeling from the economic effects that the Civil War had on the South, but also that slavery had on the South. So the 10 poorest states in America, with the exception of New Mexico, West Virginia, and Kentucky, understand in Kentucky, they were mostly a Union state, but they sent about 125,000 soldiers to fight for the Union, the North, and 35,000 for the South, were states with agrarian economies, and both retained large numbers of slaves up until the Civil War. But New Mexico didn't even exist at the time of the Civil War. So right now, the 10 poorest states in America, with the exception of New Mexico, West Virginia, and Kentucky, are the following: Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, South Carolina, Arkansas, Georgia, North Carolina. So a lot of the lack of economic success, or how the South has fallen behind so far, is still feeling the negative effects of slavery. And so if slavery was this huge benefit to America, if America really had this wonderful success story because of slavery, then why is it that the poorest states are the ones that held on to slavery for the longest? Why is it that the states that were most committed to existing under slavery are the ones that are still having the least amount of economic success? And so the Southern economy, it has a huge agricultural emphasis and relative lack of industrialization, did not have the money or capacity to support the Civil War effort. The Confederacy had less than $1 million in its treasury. And so here's the other thing, is that there were over 620,000 people that died in the American Civil War. people of all races and all backgrounds died in the American Civil War. But a predominant amount of the people that died in the Civil War were white people. And the people that were fighting on the North side were fighting under the guise of the Emancipation Proclamation. They were fighting to emancipate and to eliminate slavery. And so I think that it is an unfair analysis of history to just basically say that America is a racist country, has always been a racist country. It's much more nuanced than that. But also built upon this entire argument of slavery in general, especially from the left, we have to reject the idea that anyone has ever benefited from slavery, that slavery was ever a good thing for anybody.
Or that it had propensity to build wealth, which it just didn't. It just didn't. And I think to your point with the death, 600,000, I mean, this is potentially the most insulting part about the New York Times trying to reframe our founding from 1776 to 1619 is, A, it's just historically inaccurate. It's just wrong, and it's laughable. But you know, the sacrifices of the abolitionists, the sacrifices of the soldiers that died, all the blood that's been spilled to right this historic wrong, I mean, it wipes that away. It acts like it didn't even happen.
The reason that 1776 was our founding was not just because somebody wrote a piece of paper to the king. It was because there was a set of ideas that were all, for once, compiled in a singular document that chartered the course of Western civilization. There were none of those ideas in 1619. There was just evil happening in 1619. That's not our founding. Is that really what the New York Times think America is? Does America think that we were an evil country then and we're a bad country today? What makes 1776 so different is it embraced the ideas that the individual is sovereign, that the king must be challenged, that democratic elections must ensue, that states should have their own capacity for their own free and fair elections, that markets should be allowed to exist. That is a massive leap forward from 1619. In 1619, those ideas were not yet compiled into a singular document. So the New York Times think that, wow, that was your founding. Really? So what you're trying to say, New York Times, in your whole synthesis of this big project, is that this, we were a racist country then, and we're a racist country now. That's what they're trying to say.
When you could even make the one step further argument that the ideas contained in the Declaration of Independence and later in our Constitution, you can draw a direct line from those words to the abolition of all slaves throughout Western world.
That's right.
It doesn't matter which side of the Atlantic. Those ideas took root within the West and they abolished slavery.
That all men are created equal.
That's right. Did it happen overnight? No, Did it happen overnight? Of course not.
But like all good things, we have a struggle towards decency. And you're not going to have perfection. The struggle should always be towards decency. And the left always tries to create utopia, which will never exist. The pursuit towards utopia is nothing more than a power-enriching scheme for the left to try to make themselves more important and try to give themselves more authority over other people's lives. However, we can be more decent as a country. And so for the New York Times, do you think since 1619 America has become a more decent country? For the New York Times, do you think since 1619 America has become a more equitable and fair country? Of course we have. Now, are we a perfect country? No, we have a lot of issues and problems. We highlight a lot of them here at the Charlie Kirk Show. However, the giant leap forward, if you take a snapshot, the world from 1219 to 1619 and the world from 1619 to 2019, where was there more advancements for humankind? Well, before 1619 and 2019. Okay, that's when most people walk out of the room. Yeah, we got it. People fail to ask the next question. Why? Why? Why is it from 1619 and 2019, life expectancy has skyrocketed? The middle class has been created. We have technology that we could never have dreamed of. That we no longer have to live as serfs under rulers. That you no longer have to fight senseless wars for kings that you'll never meet. Why? Well, because of the year 1776. That's it. 1619 was just a continuation of human history. There is nothing special about 1619. There's nothing special about slaves coming to this country. You know why? Because slaves were always going somewhere. Mesopotamia, Babylonia, Indus River Valley, the Egyptians, Alexander the Great, the Romans, the Greeks, the Chinese, the British Empire. You know what all of them had in common? They all owned slaves. They all had slaves. And do you know what none of them did? None of them abolished slavery. Except eventually the British did, but it really wasn't an empire. It was more of a republic. None of them. the Babylonians, the Egyptians, Indus River Valley, Julius Caesar, to Alexander the Great, to even the great thinkers of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, none of them accomplished what America accomplished. And none of them dare fight a civil war over it. Are you kidding me? You think the Greco-Roman Wars was about abolishing slavery? Yeah, right. Could you imagine going to war over abolishing a sin? Can you tell me one time the Egyptians went to war over abolishing a sin? Over trying to right a wrong in your society? It never happened. And so what made 1776 so different is that it created a flag in the ground and said, these are our ideals. Now, did the founders live up to those ideals? No, they actually didn't. But they created the North Star, and the founders said, this is who we are. And then all of a sudden, from that point forward, it was a reference point. And so when Andrew Jackson came, and he had a really tough time justifying the continuation of slavery, and it led eventually to the emancipation movement. It led to the oxygen in the room that gave Thaddeus Stevens the capacity to slam down his fist and say, we should stand firmly for emancipation. And states like Vermont were early emancipators, and that's great, and it led that trend towards the abolition of slavery. But the idea of slaves being in an evil context, and I'm not trying to cheapen this whatsoever, and I'm being very precise what I'm saying, but the idea of slaves being put on another continent was not something transformational. 1619 was not some sort of breakthrough in human history. It was something that has happened forever. Slaves being transported to another area is something that had happened for thousands of years before it. What was different was when people rebelled against a ruler and recognized that rights are equitable for all people. And then the year after, Vermont abolishes slavery. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? That a year after, Vermont inspired by the American founding.
By the Declaration of Independence, the Vermont legislature was so inspired that they abolished slavery the next year. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, because, you know, it's this quote from the New York Times talking about putting 1619 at the very center of the story we tell ourselves about who we are. And it's like, I'm not that person. You're not that person.
Do you know anyone who is that person?
You know what also is our story? That the Liberty Bell was named by abolitionists. That our great president, President Lincoln, when he died and he was being viewed by the reports were that it stretched around two miles long of people waiting to pay their respects to President Lincoln. He was resting underneath the Liberty Bell with a verse from Leviticus talking about liberty throughout the land. This is part of our story. Martin Luther King is part of our story. Thaddeus Stevens is part of our story. I mean, you could make a stronger argument that the true year of our founding would be 1865, of the Civil War.
If you look at the founding fathers, I mean, you look at John Adams and John Quincy Adams, who are so committed towards the abolition of slavery. It's much more nuanced and much more complex than just saying all the founding fathers were completely and totally racist, and there was nothing besides that. And so look, with the left, what is the left really trying to do here? Let's try to pinpoint here. What is their thing? Well, they admitted it to us in this leaked transcript. They told us that their Russian propaganda scheme to destroy Donald Trump failed. He's being very open with us that their metaphorical sniper rifle against Donald Trump that they thought was going to be the quote-unquote political kill shot. Again, I'm talking metaphorically. But they thought this is going to be the thing that took out Donald Trump, failed. So they transition to what? To racism. So it goes from Russia to racism to recession. We'll talk about recession in a second. And so this is why the 1619 Project was started. Despite the historical illiteracy, despite the philosophical inaccuracy, and despite the lack of depth on this issue, they are trying to destroy Donald Trump by putting us back into a discussion. And here's the other thing I can't understand. The left always says, well, it's time we have an honest conversation about race in this country. Did we not have one in the 1960s during the Civil Rights Act? Did we not have an honest conversation about race back then? I'm very confused. At what point did we not have an honest conversation about race in this country? I mean, in fact, let's actually play this clip. I like unifying Obama. I like the unity Obama. Back in the 2004 Democrat convention when Obama tried to bring our country together.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
And so now let's contrast that with a modern leftist. So there's unifying Obama in 2004 and now divided left today.
I would say our country should be more fearful of white men across our country, because they are actually causing most of the deaths within this country. We should be profiling, monitoring, and creating policies to fight the radicalization of white men.
And look, we could play clip after clip after clip of how the left is now so hyper-focused on race to divide us. And the answer is, or the question really, I should say, is why? Well, because they're using this in defiance of the Latin phrase e pluribus unum, in defiance of our founding value, out of many one. The Latin phrase e pluribus unum means out of many one, to try to divide our country instead of trying to unite our country. And so the next thing that the left is trying to do, they're trying to convince us into recession. So it goes from Russia, that's done. They're done with the Russia thing. Now to racism, that's not going to work. And then they're going to try to convince us into a recession. Do you know what I call these people, Mr. Producer? I call them economic hypochondriacs. Do you know what a hypochondriac is? And someone who always thinks that they're sick. It's the kid that's trying to convince their parent, I'm sick, I don't want to go to school. No, you're fine, go to school. I'm sick, I don't want... This is the left. They're trying to find a recession when there isn't one. Do you know how you know when you're in a recession? You don't have to figure it out. You know you're in a recession, okay? That's how you know you're in a recession. You don't need some analyst on CNBC to tell you that you're in a recession. It's when the boss comes in and says, we're going to have to let you go. Or all of a sudden, groceries skyrocket and you have stagflation. People who have lived through recessions like we did in 2008, you know you're in a recession. You don't need the commentators to tell you that you're in a recession. But guess what? You know what the problem with economics is? The problem with this is that the left can actually convince us into a recession. In fact, let's play a short clip, a montage of all these people saying that we're coming up into a recession.
Trump waking up this morning to a trending hashtag he was likely desperate to change. Hashtag Trump recession. It came alongside headlines warning that the economy is in distress, maybe even headed for a nosedive, which Trump's own aides admit could spell political disaster for the president and could pose the gravest threat yet to his reelection prospects.
I call this another Trump slump.
A giant dark cloud has taken its new place on the horizon as potential big trouble for the Trump economy.
The threat of recession is real.
But if the global economy, including the United States, is taking a step toward recession, what does that mean for this presidency?
Ooh, it's political suicide.
So the left is trying all these different inaccurate and very deceiving narratives to try to make sure Donald Trump does not win a second term. Russia, racism, recession, one after the other. And I just have to go back to these kind of narratives that is put forth by the left. At what, and this kind of transitions nicely. This kind of is the appetizer, to you will, to the entree of them trying to boost support in the urban cities that they're losing support with the black community. They think this is going to win the black. You think a black mother who can't send their kid to a good school and has to go to sleep listening to gunshots at night and is worried about their kid's safety really wants to hear about 1619? You think that 1619 is really going to win? You think that a black mother who just wants to send their kid to a charter school wants to be lectured about from some white liberal that's educated at Harvard about 1619? Yeah, that's going to solve our problems. How about this? I got five words that will win the election for Donald Trump. School choice for black kids. Five words. I have an op-ed coming out on this shortly, and I talked about it with Steve Hilton on his show. School choice for black kids. Not focusing on, okay, focusing on 1619. You know what's amazing? So let's juxtapose what the left wants us to focus on, which is the negative 1619. We want to focus on the positives of 1776. All men created equal. Okay, because of that, you live in Compton, you should be able to send your kid to a better school. Okay, left. But we live in a racist, horrible country that because of 1619. Okay, We got your argument. What are you going to do to improve America today? How about school choice for black kids? You're against school choice for black kids? You're against those five words? So here on the Charlie Kirk Show, we like to talk about solutions. So here are some solutions. School choice for black kids. Rebuilding the American family. Talking about making our community safe again by not having a war on police. These sorts of things could actually improve our inner cities and improve our country instead of having some sort of, you know what this is designed for? This sort of 1619 thing? Only in university would you have so much time to talk about something like this. You think that the kitchen table issues right now on the south side of Chicago, while their kids are getting killed in the street, is talking about Jamestown, Virginia in 1619? You think that's a kitchen table issue? Hold on. I know we got 45 people shot in the last week in Chicago, but guys, come on. 1619. Like, are we honest with ourselves right now? 1619. We got to go back to 1619. And their whole argument, this is such an academic calisthenic exercise where these are people in at 9 a.m. in a room with everyone has a doctorate. They run out of things to talk about. Well, we need to now get the New York Times to talk about the inequality that's happened in America because of, guess what, 1619. Oh, really? This is going to be the big rallying point for the left heading into 2020. What do you think, Mr. Producer?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. It's like, stop telling me about 1619. Tell me about 2019. And then, you know, the other thing that occurs to me, it's just like, who wants to be told that their country is terrible all the time? How is that a winning proposition for the left? I mean, go around and tell a bunch of proud people their country sucks.
But then they want them to vote for us. Like, so this is the left. You live in a horrible place, and it's absolutely hard. Now vote for us. I'm sorry. I thought you said we live in a horrible country. This is what I love about the left, is that they're all running for president. We live in a racist and bigoted and homophobic country. Like, why do you want to be president of a country like that? That sounds like a horrible place.
I love it so much that I want to change it and make it better.
Yeah, we want to fundamentally transform the hatred. And only I can fundamentally transform the hatred away from America.
And honestly, we were talking about this in show prep. It's like, it reminds me of when, you know, listen, love them to death, love my European friends, but when they come to America and they go, well, I really like it here, but, you know, this is really kind of messed up about America. And it's like, okay, okay, take that once. Next comment, oh, well, you guys don't do this right in America. It's like, eventually it gets a little bit exhausting to talk to Europeans about what we need to do in America.
By the way, when a Frenchman tries to tell me how to run their country, like, can you have one weekend without protests? Can you just have one weekend without Parisians
in the
street? But listen,
this is what the left has become. They're just constant whining, how terrible it all is.
The left has become hyper-credentialed elites that live in Manhattan and Malibu that want to program society and try to destroy anyone that is a voice for the working class.
And they want to erase history. 1619, for anybody listening, is not when we were founded. It was 1776,
by the way,
folks.
I got another year for you. And then we'll move on to our next very important topic. 1860. What happened in 1860?
It's the beginning of the Civil War.
It's also the beginning of the Republican Party. It was founded in Ripon, Wisconsin as a one-issue party, a singular-issue party, an abolition party. They were focused solely on the abolition of slavery. And you actually want to talk about who were the people what is the line of continuation? They want to talk about 1619? Okay, the left. You want to talk about 1619? What is the line of continuation? Who right now in American society is more focused on keeping black people poor, Democrats or Republicans? I just gave a solution. School choice for black kids. What are five words that you'll make black people's lives better? Because you've had 40 years to do it. What have you done in 40 years? You spent $15 trillion. Our inner cities are a mess. Our schools are broken. Our families are deteriorated. Crime is through the roof. I got five words that will guarantee to make people's lives better. School choice for black kids.
I got a few more. Economic zones.
That's right. Opportunity zones. Economic zones.
Opportunity.
All these sorts of great things, right? And we could talk about policy with this. So, but guess what? The Democrats back in the 1860s, the Democrats back in the 1620s, but there weren't even Democrats back then, but the people that were actually controlling, you know, the kind of the controlling slavery, because the Democrats were always the slavery party. They just were. The Democrats were always in favor of slavery. And the anti-slavery, the abolitionists, were the Republicans. Pro-freedom, pro-individual liberty, pro-free expression. Well, who are the people right now that are so focused on group identity? Which side right now? The Republicans or the Democrats are more focused on group identity. Oh my goodness, it's not even close. It's the Democrats. Who's more focused on the individual right now? Republicans. It's not even close. Wouldn't it be nice if search engines and social media sites were unbiased platforms that didn't choose a side politically? Yeah, keep dreaming. In 2016, the tech elites at Google bragged about donating millions of dollars to Hillary Clinton. These big tech companies that push their political agenda and restrict the free speech rights of conservatives are the very same corporations we're trusting to handle our personal data online. I don't want them using my history, metadata, or video searches against me. That's why I use ExpressVPN every single time I go online. Big tech companies can match your internet activity to your identity or location using your public IP address. When I use ExpressVPN, these tech companies can't see my IP address at all. My identity is masked and anonymized by a secure VPN server. Plus, ExpressVPN has the added benefit of encrypting 100% of your data to keep you safe from hackers and internet bad guys. Does that sound complicated? Well, look, it's actually not. I promise. I use ExpressVPN all the time. I'm using it right now. I use it on my phone. I use it on my computer. I use it on my tablet. And you guys have to as well. Do you want foreign governments or tech companies to look at your stuff? Well, if you do, then I don't know why you would, because that's a really bad reason. So if the answer is no, of course I don't, then you want ExpressVPN. The data belongs to you, not the tech oligarchs, not the tech elites. ExpressVPN is your answer. There's no excuse. Get it today. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free. ExpressVPN.com/Charlie. That's ExpressVPN.com/Charlie for 3 months free for a one-year package. Visit ExpressVPN.com/Charlie to learn more. So I want to shift gears to a super important topic that I've been keeping my eyes on. And actually, I was thinking of actually going personally and visiting this very crisis. And I got some advice from somebody I really trust, one of the top financiers and one of the biggest critics on China. He said, Charlie, have you ever been critical of China? I said, yeah, I've been pretty critical of China. He said, do not go to Hong Kong. I said, why not? He said, they might not let you in. They'll have their eyes on you. You will not be safe in Hong Kong. So the protests that are happening in Hong Kong right now is one of the most important things happening geopolitically on Earth. And so many of you have probably heard about Hong Kong in general. Some of you have probably heard of what's going on. We're going to give you the straight facts right now. And then I'm going to tell you something that the Hong Kong protesters wish they had that they're totally and completely missing. So first of all, just some fast facts about Hong Kong. Current Hong Kong's population right now is 7.8 million people. 7.8 million people. So to put that in perspective, that's smaller than the population of Illinois. Just to give you, I mean, that's just about the population of a, you know, mid-sized state. So they're not a huge population. They're an island. They became a colony of the British Empire at the end of the First Opium War in 1842, followed by Kowloon, I'm probably mispronouncing that, in 1860 after the Second Opium War. And the modern territory was completed in 1898, 99-year British lease over the new territories, which comprised 89% of the Hong Kong's island. So I just have to laugh for a second. You know, you sign these 99-year leases, Mr. Producer, and you think that they're never going to, you know, mean anything. And all of a sudden, the lease comes up. And guess what? In 1997, the lease was up. And so guess what? Sovereignty over the territory was restored to China in 1997 because that 99-year lease was up. It actually functions as a special administrative region. Hong Kong maintains their own governing and economic systems separate from those of mainland China. Its people tend to identify more as Hong Kongers than Chinese. Hong Kong is a special administrative region, an SAR of China, with executive, legislative, and judicial powers that are devolved from the national government. So Hong Kong, there's really not an American equivalent of this, but I'm trying to think of what like the
well,
best
you know,
example
back
of this
in the day,
be.
I mean, Texans often refer to themselves first as Texans.
Yeah.
And actually, with the founding of the country, a lot of Americans used to call themselves, you know, first I'm a Virginian, I'm an American.
So,
and that has, over the years, become less of obviously a thing. We find ourselves to be Americans
first, not in Hong Kong.
When you
have these really powerful kind of semi-galactic empire type countries like China that are created, you kind of have these external countries that are always just kind of a stick in the side, if you will, right, Mr. Producer, of the country. So what was it for the Soviet Union? It was East and West Berlin. That was kind of their thorn in the side of their Soviet empire that they were trying to create. And Hong Kong is that for the Chinese. They've never been able to totally control Hong Kong. It's always really bothered them. Same with Taiwan. Taiwan is just an eternal problem for the Chinese. They think that they govern Taiwan. The Taiwanese want their own government, their own structure. They don't consider any sort of allegiance at all to China. And so here's a really important thing, and this is from a history textbook. It says, quote, although Britain transferred its sovereignty of Hong Kong, however, Hong Kong nonetheless maintained some institutions that were separate from mainland China, such as its own legislature, independent judiciary. This framework, known as one country, two systems, has existed for 22 years, but protesters in Hong Kong are worried that the proposed changes for the extradition bill would give Beijing greater influence over the region. Before I go any further, just some top-line facts about China really quick. China right now is America's greatest enemy. Right now, there's millions of Muslims in concentration camps in China. China's trying to take over the world. Our trade policies have heavily benefited China. China's GDP is growing rather slower today than it used to be, but generally very, very quickly. China has total goals to take over most of sub-Saharan Africa and ports of entry all around the world, as well in South America. China has no freedom of expression for its individuals. China is a very atheistic, secular country. China has contempt for the West, and the more that we've traded with China, China has actually become more authoritarian and more aggressive towards the West. And so here's a little bit about the extradition agreement that was kind of struck. In February 2019, Hong Kong Security Bureau proposed changes to regional extradition laws that would allow people to be extradited from Hong Kong to mainland China, Reuters reported. Critics feared the bill would undermine the independence of Hong Kong's legal system and put Hong Kong citizens and foreign nationals at risk by allowing suspects to be sent to mainland China for trial, and that's from Reuters. Protesters believe that mainland China could play a role in drafting the law in order to gain more control over Hong Kong citizens, and they're right. Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, denies this claim. Protesters are demanding her resignation due to what they perceive to be dishonesty to her citizens and loyalty to Beijing. So you kind of have Hong Kong that is having its 1776 moment. Mr. Producer, this is their 1776 moment. They are literally flying American flags in the streets and singing the national anthem. And I'm telling you right now, we should do even more to support the people of Hong Kong. China is an evil country. China is an evil country. I'm so sick and tired of this quote-unquote alliance that we have with China. I'm not saying we have to go to war with them. I'm not proposing that. I mean, there's a lot of evil countries out there. I did a whole podcast about how evil Iran was and how we shouldn't go to war with them. I mean, I've spoken time and time again about countries that are evil and countries that are not our friend that we should stand up against. I mean, I think North Korea is evil, but I think it's good that we're talking to them. I think that, you know, for example, another country I've been very critical of, and Mr. Producer, you know this, I mean, Saudi Arabia funded 9/11, 15 and 19, the hijackers were Saudi Arabian. I mean, Saudi Arabia funds madrasas all over the world. Saudi Arabia is behind a lot of the rise of Islamic terrorism. I don't think we should go to war with them. So just because I think China is evil does not mean I think we should go to war.
Well, again, there's a distinction between the government of China and the way
people.
That they...
Yeah, that's
and
a really yeah, important and point. It's a great
Iran,
point.
Iran is the same way. A lot of the people in Iran are incredibly liberal, progressive people.
The Persians are great.
The Persians are great. They live under a dictatorial, oppressive regime. And a lot of the Chinese, when you get them on the street, they talk, you know, very sensibly. They want more openness. They want more freedoms. And the same thing's happening in Hong Kong.
Precisely. And so look, the demands of the Hong Kong people are this. They want democracy. They want universal suffrage so Hong Kong residents have the right to elect their own leaders through general elections without the intervention of the Chinese Communist government. Mr. Producer, this sounds like 1776. This sounds like a petition to King George. They want an autonomous government duly elected by the people so they can achieve the rights and freedoms we have in the United States, including free speech and the right to keep and bear arms. Can you believe it? They want the right to keep and bear arms. This, the extradition bill, which started the protest, to be completely withdrawn. Now I have to take a step back. And you're going, this is, guess what? Mr. Producer, for those of you listening to the Charlie Kirk Show, this is Charlie Kirk Show exclusive commentary. I've not heard this anywhere. This is Charlie Kirk exclusive commentary. So number one, let's go back to the brilliance of the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers studied human history. They studied the Greeks. They studied the Romans. They studied the Chinese. That's right. They studied the Indus River Valley. They studied the Egyptians, the Mesopotamians, the Babylonians, the Aztecs, the Mayans, the Incans. And they found this, that human beings are rather predictable creatures, that we will act in certain ways, and that we will time and time again, unfortunately, embrace tyranny. And one of the best ways to prevent against tyranny is to have some capacity that there can be equilibrium within the people and the rulers. And so, Mr. Producer, what did they put in place to make sure of that? Well, they put in place to make sure that citizens could be armed. Could you imagine right now if every Hong Kong protester had an AR-15 sitting at home? All this wouldn't be a protest. This would be what, Mr. Producer? This would be a negotiation.
And I mean, we were talking about this in show prep, and I think this take is brilliant, honestly.
This is the best argument for the Second Amendment you're ever going to see.
It's funny. It's in the contrast between the New York Times trying to rewrite our history and these Hong Kongers.
Because this is real in real time.
These Hong Kongers clinging to the true story of our founding, the freedom fighters. The spirit of 1776 is alive and well in Hong Kong. Meanwhile, it's dead and gone in the New York Times editorial.
It's totally dead. And so right now, imagine if every Hong... This is the best argument for the Second Amendment you're ever going to find. Because the Second Amendment is not to hunt deer, and it's not for personal protection. Those two things are important. But what is the Second Amendment really about? To fight government tyranny. And Mr. Producer, every single... This really upsets me, because every time I say this on a college campus, people say, oh, there's no more government tyranny. You're talking about something that's never going to exist. Right now, in Hong Kong, there's government tyranny. And people are standing up against it. There's hundreds of thousands of young people that want freedom. They want freedom from a tyrannical government. And for the leftists out there that are totally silent, shame on you. For the liberals and the media out there that are not covering this appropriately, I condemn you completely and categorically. Because here's what's happening. You have these people that want what? They want democracy. They want freedom of expression. But what have I always said, Mr. Producer? There is no First Amendment without the Second Amendment.
And you're seeing that play out.
But guess what? the Hong Kong people, unless the West comes to their aid, unless America says definitively, we stand with the people of Hong Kong, they're going to lose this. What are the gun laws in Hong Kong right now? According to Section 13 of Cap 238, the Firearms and Ammunition Ordinance, essentially, no person shall have in their possession any arms or ammunition unless he or she holds a special license for possession of such arms or ammunition or a dealer's license of such items. Those in possession of illegal firearms can face up to 14 years in prison. Smuggling of guns is punishable by death. You are recommended by your club to possess. Essentially, you have to be part of a gun club. There's no private ownership of guns. Why is this? The Chinese government knew that if 1 million people in Hong Kong had AR-15s, for example, the gun that the left hates, all of a sudden they said, wait a second, we wouldn't have protests. We could have a civil war in our hands. Now, I don't want a civil war. I don't want armed conflict. You have to understand, it's the Reagan doctrine of peace through strength in a micro lens. This is peace through strength when a million people all of a sudden have negotiation power. They have no leverage. So if the Chinese bring in their military right now, you know what it is? It's a hostage situation. It's not a negotiation. But if the Chinese military walks into Hong Kong with their tanks and you got a million people with AR-15s waiting for you, all of a sudden you're like, wait a second, hold on. We might lose our lives here. We're not really, you know, we love this, you know, Xi Jinping guy, but I don't know about this. Right now they know that they're going to be unopposed. The Chinese military can go door to door and kill whoever they want to kill. They can mow down whatever apartment building they want to without anyone getting in their way. However, with an armed citizenry, it changes the entire dynamics of the conversation and changes the entire dichotomy of how the entire process happens. Instead of protesters trying to create attention up against the citizens, they're going to be treated as equals. They'll be treated as sovereign beings because there will be the imbalance that happens when there's no armament of the citizens is so remarkable and cannot be ignored. And this is the argument for the Second Amendment. If Hong Kong embraced the Second Amendment for the last 100 years and all their citizens were armed like the Israeli citizens were armed and the Swiss citizens were armed and the American citizens were armed, my goodness, they wouldn't have this. You know what China would say? Yeah, you can have your own Hong Kong. You can do your own thing. You can have your own separatist government. We don't want a civil war. We don't want an uprising. We don't want carnage in the streets. We don't want to lose our own 100,000 people because these Hong Kong people are ready to die. They're ready to die, but they don't have the ability to die. They're just going to die as martyrs, as victims. But if you have the ability to shoot back and they're coming with tanks and they're coming with guns, good luck trying to try to quell that kind of rebellion.
Absolutely. And I think the whole intellectual argument for the Second Amendment. The whole point of having the guns is so you don't have to use them in this instance.
Of course, that's what I'm saying. And look, the Chinese are kind of smirking because they're like, well, if we got to bring in the military, we will. And if we have to shoot a couple people, we will. But they're not going to shoot back because they don't have guns. They know they don't have guns because they put these ordinances in. They know the laws that Hong Kong is living under. But good. So, for example, 7 million people. Could you think right now if just hypothetically, let's just play a thought exercise. If by a snap of fingers, I transferred the people of Hong Kong with the people of Missouri. All of a sudden, Hong Kong is Missouri. And China tries to go into Missouri and tell them how to live their life. Okay, good luck with that. You're going to have quite a few people with weapons behind the blade of every grass defending their own sovereignty and defending their own personal liberty and defending their property. And so all of a sudden Hong Kong says, all of a sudden China says, we have an extradition treaty. We are going to say, oh, really? Are you going to enforce that? Because we're going to protect our freedoms with everything that we got. We got AR-15s. We got rifles. We got pistols. Come and take it.
And you think Charlie's not making this up? I mean,
this is happening in real time.
This is literally what this is what
the Japanese thought when they were going to invade America. The generals feared this. So let's play a fun thought exercise for the liberals listening to this show, and I hope liberals listen to the Charlie Kirk Show. And for those of you that are listening, please go give us 5 stars and press subscribe. It really helps us out. For the liberals listening to the show, this is a great question to ask liberals. Okay, Mr. Producer, you're going to love this. Number one, do you think China is an immoral and ethical government? Most liberals will say yes. Okay. Number two, do you stand with the people of Hong Kong? Yes. Number three, do you wish they had guns? That's the line of questioning. Three questions to ask a liberal. Number one, do you think China is an evil, oppressive regime? Of course they are. They have Muslims in concentration camps. They're creating a social control empire. This country is an enemy of the United States. Enemy. Number two, do you stand with the people of Hong Kong? Oh, yes, I do. I sit my macchiato. I totally stand with the people. Okay. Do you wish they had guns? No, I don't. Really, you don't wish they have guns? So you want them to get mowed down by the evil Chinese? You just said they're evil. You just said you stand with the people of Hong Kong. They want guns. So if you stood with them, then you wish they had guns. And if the answer is yes, I hope they have guns, well then, if the Hong Kong people have guns, then why can't we have guns? Do you understand how quickly a government can become tyrannical? How quickly the government can be used against you? my goodness, God bless Thomas Jefferson, and God bless James Madison, and God bless John Adams, because they saw this coming. And they have the reason America is still the freest, most generous, benevolent, creative country ever to exist in the history of the world is we have an armed citizenry. And I, Mr. Producer, I'm going to tell you right now, I have never believed in the value of the Second Amendment more as I did today looking at what's happening in Hong Kong. It's no longer just like a thought exercise, no longer just dealing in charts and graphs and what ifs and hypotheticals. In real time, as you're listening to this podcast, there are 400,000 people in Hong Kong that are fighting for their life against tyranny. This is not like history book type stuff. This is not like revisionist history. Right now, they are pleading, they're on their hands and knees, give us a way to protect ourselves against the Chinese, and they do not have it.
I just think if you put yourself into the founders' mentality of 1776, you understand if you can sort of get your mind there, which admittedly is very difficult, especially for, you know, probably your modern average American that's not steeped in history and doesn't love studying history. But when you have an oppressive government that is lording over you, and they're willing to use military force to subdue you, then you understand the Second Amendment in a whole new light. But that feels like ancient history, and in some ways it really is, but that's why we have to tell the story again and again and again. But China is a living reminder to all of us right now that if you want the First Amendment, if you want the freedoms of expression, if you want the freedoms to pursue your life as you see fit, then the Second Amendment is a necessary check and balance against the tyranny of an oppressive government.
Amen. Well, son, we stand with the people of Hong Kong, and we wish that they had guns, and we wish they had the ability to defend their rights that all human beings have when they're born. And this is the argument for the Scottish Enlightenment ideals of natural rights that really my boy Descartes, I think therefore I am, started the Renaissance and transitioned to Bacon, to Hume, to Smith, to Locke, to Jefferson, to Adams, to Madison, to eventually Trump. That's right, all the way down there. And I do have a book coming out soon. You will hear all about it very, very soon. So I have a favor for you. If you're enjoying this show, please right now, make sure you're subscribed and make sure your best friend, whoever that best friend is right now, text that best friend and say, hey, do me a favor, subscribe to this podcast. I cannot tell you how much that helps our podcast. That boosts us in the charts. Mr. Producer, you're the data guy. Tell us how much it helps.
Helps a lot. Actually, it helps a lot. And I will say, we're getting a lot of questions from the audience.
We have an AMA coming out.
Asking about when are we going to do the AMA. You left a question. Are we ever going to get to it? Actually, about a week and a half ago, Charlie recorded an AMA when we were in Phoenix. It's fantastic. You guys are not going to want to miss that. But if you asked a question on the Apple, as we have you do in the comment section on the Apple Podcast, chances are we probably got to it already. And if you have another question, ask it again. Leave another comment. Ask another question. We'll get to it. We love recording the AMAs. Charlie has a lot of fun with them. We have a lot of fun with them. The team. We put a lot of research and show prep into these, and you know, it's a lot of fun.
Please,
so do it.
Please leave a comment. Leave 5 stars. And just one final thing. This kind of just goes back to the negativity of the left. I mean, they want us to focus more as a country of the 1619 country. We want to be a 1776 and an 1860 country. And so live that out every single day. There's no way you could focus on being a 1619 country and be thankful you live in America. That makes you angry. Be thankful that you live in the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. Again, thank you guys for listening. Give us those 5-star ratings. Press subscribe. Get one of a friend to do so. This is your home of conservative, libertarian, rational thinking. Till next time, this is Charlie Kirk signing off for The Charlie Kirk Show.
Hey, everybody, it's Laura Ingraham, and I'd like to invite you to check out my new show, The Laura Ingraham Podcast, exclusively on Podcast One. So join me 3 days a week as I cover politics, the culture, everything in between, laugh, learn, all at the same time. We got you locked and loaded, and you'll be ready for the week, ready for the month. And it's very easy. You just subscribe today, download new episodes exclusively at podcastone.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And you know mine's going to be one of your newest.